can't help thinking about volcanoes in our part of the world because we live near them. Crater Lake, volcano. Mount Shasta, volcano. Mount McLaughlin, Mount Bailey, Mount Thielson, volcano, volcano, volcano. You get the picture. So does the University of Oregon. It is putting more resources into the study of volcanoes, dedicating one of the university's clusters of excellence to volcanology. Once a month at least, we visit with U of O professors for a segment we call Curious, Research Meets Radio. This month we learn about clusters of excellence and how they are chosen, and how cluster designation in this case will boost volcano studies. Dr. Paul Wallace is the head of the University of Oregon Earth Sciences Department and the head of the Volcanology Cluster of Excellence. Dr. Wallace, thanks for joining us today in the Exchange.
Hey, thank you very much, Jeff. I'm really happy to be here today with you.
Good to have you. Let's start with the simple general stuff. What is a cluster of excellence?
A couple of years ago, the University of Oregon decided to try to focus resources into some key areas, building on strengths that they already had, where they wanted to target additional hiring of new faculty, setting up new research labs. And so they had a competitive process where groups of people at the university wrote proposals to compete for these, and we were fortunately one of 10 groups that was chosen for a new cluster in volcanology, volcanic hazards, and geothermal energy.
So about 10 clusters altogether, is that what you said?
That's right. There were about 10 that were chosen, and some are being funded through private donations to the university, and some are being funded with internal university funds.
And so how many different proposals were submitted? I'm curious to know how heavy the competition was for those 10 slots.
I think it was around 35 proposals.
Mm-hmm. Okay. So a fair amount of weeding out that had to be done here.
Yeah, exactly.
Was volcanology kind of a no-brainer for folks in the Earth Sciences Department, considering where we live?
Well, yeah, we live right in the middle of volcanoes and sort of active geology and plate tectonics in general. You know, earthquakes, landslides, all kinds of active processes really happen here in our backyard. And volcanology is something that the University of Oregon has been especially strong in really since the mid-1960s, when a very notable volcanologist, Professor Alexander McBurney, came here to the university and really created a program. So ever since then, we've had a real strength in that area.
Since the time of Professor McBurney, how far has the science of volcanology itself come along? I'm just curious to know if we know a whole lot more about volcanoes now than we did 50 years ago.
Yeah, it has really changed a lot. And, you know, like virtually all aspects of science, new kinds of technology have really revolutionized what you can do. So back in those days, you mostly did volcanology by observing active volcanoes or going and looking at the deposits from past eruptions. And those are tools we still use very, very commonly. But today, we do a lot using seismometers to detect earthquakes underneath volcanoes, to track how magma is moving. We use satellite-based instruments to look at how the ground surface on a volcano swells as it fills up with magma. We can track volcanic plumes and ash in the atmosphere as it travels around the globe through the stratosphere using satellite instruments. So things have really been revolutionized.
So we've gone from a place where we knew a great deal about eventually what happened with volcanoes many and sometimes millions of years ago. It sounds like we're at a place now where we understand more about what goes on volcanoes in the present. How close are we to getting to a point of seeing what volcanoes will do in the future?
Well, that's obviously one of the key things that we're all working towards, being able to better predict different types of volcanic activity. And you really have to think about predicting on different kinds of timescales. So you take Mount St. Helens as an example with its 1980 eruption. The volcano had been quiet for a very long time before that eruption. And there started to be rumblings, earthquakes, underground about a month or so before the eruption. And so that was the first warning sign. So on that kind of time scale, or a month or two building up to an eruption, scientists have gotten really good at looking at the different types of signals you can measure, whether it's detecting earthquakes, again, using GPS and satellite instruments to look at ground swelling, or measuring volcanic gases. People have gotten pretty good at being able to forecast the types of things that are going to happen. And in particular, within the United States, the U.S. Geological Survey and their Volcano Hazards Program has the primary responsibility for monitoring of active volcanoes. So they've gotten a lot of experience over the years at doing that. Where we're still a long way off is a longer-term prediction, because volcanoes will often go for hundreds or even thousands of years with no activity and then come back to life again. And that's a much, much harder thing to make predictions about. But again, new tools like using seismometers to measure earthquakes allows us to detect how magma is moving deep underground. And some of the satellite tools that allow us to measure ground deformation have showed us that it's quite common that the ground in a region around a volcano will swell as a result of magma intrusion, but oftentimes that doesn't result in an eruption. So we're able to look over the longer term, try to understand a little bit more about what causes an eruption and what leads to a failed eruption where magma intrudes but never quite makes it to the surface.
When you talk about swelling of ground, how much are we talking about here?
Well, you know, at a small scale, it can be something like uplift of a few centimeters per year. So, for example, in the early 2000s, scientists using a satellite technique called INSAR were able to detect an area where the ground was bulging upwards just to the west of the South Sister volcano here in central Oregon. And the ground, you know, over an area of a few kilometers was going up up to a couple of centimeters a year. So that was almost certainly magma intruding into the ground that could potentially have led to a small eruption, kind of like the small cinder cone volcanoes that you see around McKenzie Pass area in central Oregon.
We're talking about volcanoes and the volcano cluster of the Volcanology Cluster of Excellence Initiative at the University of Oregon with Dr. Paul Wallace, who heads the Oregon Earth Sciences Department. You can join us on the exchange at 800-838-3760 with your questions about volcanoes in our region and what goes on underneath them and what comes out of them. You can also join us by email at jx@jeffnet.org. So the idea of the swelling of the ground, is this the kind of thing that might actually, you know, could move foundations or, you know, crack things in people's houses or stuff and they really wouldn't know why?
You know, in most cases, any swelling of the ground is going to be either on the volcano itself or in areas that are close by to the volcano. So, you know, in most cases, people don't live in close enough proximity that would affect them.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
But it is something, again, we can detect using GPS networks on the ground or using satellite instruments. And, you know, another real classic example of that kind of bulging on a large scale was what happened with Mount St. Helens before its eruption on May 18th, 1980. The top of the volcano itself started to bulge, and the north flank bulged, you know, dangerously outward, causing it to be oversteepened and eventually fail. And that, again, was because magma was moving up into the edifice, the volcano itself, and was pressurizing the system in there and was causing the ground surface near the top of the volcano to bulge outwards.
That's a story that still fascinates me about Mount St. Helens itself, though, is that it sounds like that bulging actually caused a landslide that essentially uncapped the volcano.
Yeah, that's right. It was part of a kind of a complicated triggering sequence of an earthquake and landslide that basically caused it to become unplugged. The pressure had built up, you know, and quite a bit of new magma was feeding from deeper underground, and that really triggered the eruption. And that's, you know, one of the big questions volcanologists are really interested in is what are the things that actually trigger volcanic eruptions to start in the end? Are they, you know, they can be internally driven where new magma, you know, fills a space under the volcano and pressurizes it. And in some cases, they may have external kinds of triggering mechanisms as well.
So what kinds of expertise do you want to bring in to the Volcanology Cluster of Excellence?
So two main areas, really, that we're looking at. One of them is the use of sophisticated computer models to try to do simulations of explosive volcanic eruptions. So looking at the kinds of explosive plumes that rise, you know, 10, 20, 30 kilometers up into the atmosphere and then can have impacts on aviation and so forth and cause ashfall deposits that are a hazard to people. And also modeling of pyroclastic flows, which can be so deadly as they come out of erupting volcanoes and race down the flanks of volcanoes at, you know, many tens of miles an hour, carrying hot particles and hot gases and so forth. So one of the big areas we're targeting is someone who does those kinds of sophisticated computer models, because it's really hard to understand the processes that are happening in pyroclastic flows and plumes because you can't see inside of them. They're so filled with ash and pumice fragments that you can see the outsides of them, but you can't really see very well what's going on inside them. So that's one of the areas we're looking at, because it connects both basic research into how volcanoes and their eruptions work, and then it has a translational side into thinking about volcanic hazards. You know, I mentioned aviation a moment ago. Everybody learned a big lesson during the 2010 Eyjafjallajökull eruption.
Easy for you to say.
Yeah.
I'm glad you said it instead of me.
I had to practice quite a bit to get it right. So that shut down European airspace for days and created enormous economic losses just because people couldn't move, you know, products couldn't move and so forth. And a lot of the problem there was a lack of models and tools for predicting where the volcanic ash plume was going to go exactly. So that's, anyway, that's an example of how the kind of basic research we'd like to do here can translate into information that's useful to people who deal with volcanic hazards and try to mitigate or minimize the impacts of volcanoes. The second position we're looking for is somebody who uses satellite techniques to look at ground deformation, the swelling of volcanoes, and so forth, to help track magma movement underground and understand the precursors leading up to eruptions, understand more about what triggers eruptions, what causes failed volcanic eruptions, and so forth.
So with the sensitivity of those satellites, I mean, is it a pretty good measurement? Are we talking down to the centimeter level to be able to detect?
Yeah, getting even down to millimeter kind of levels, yeah, with the satellite radar technique. And so both the satellite method can be used, and then GPS networks that can be set up on the ground are also quite useful as well. So you can really use a combination of tools. But the satellite method allows you to look at volcanic areas in remote places all around the world.
This is the Jefferson Exchange. We are enjoying our monthly Curious segment, which is about research at the University of Oregon, Research Meets Radio. We're talking to Dr. Paul Wallace, who's the head of the University of Oregon Earth Sciences Department and the head of the Volcanology Cluster of Excellence. So we're learning about clusters of excellence and volcanology at the same time. And you can join the conversation on the Exchange. Your questions and comments are welcome about the subject matter at hand. 800-838-3760 to come in by phone. You can send emails to jx@jeffnet.org. Here's a call from Anne and Eugene. Welcome to the Exchange.
Yes, thank you. I was fortunate enough to be on the Big Island of Hawaii in January, and from a helicopter saw down into the crater of Pu'u'o'o, and also watching it pump molten lava into the ocean. So I was wondering, since those are the most active volcanoes in the U.S., if your geologists do any study there. And I'll take my answer off the phone, off the radio. Thanks.
All right. Thank you, Ann.
Yes, we do. Several of us have worked at the Kilauea volcano. My colleague Leif Karlstrom is working there now, trying to use seismic signals, the passage of earthquakes through the shallow part of the magma-filled conduit, to understand something more about how lava is transported in the shallow part of the volcano. And I've done studies in the past as well, trying to understand the different ways in which lava erupts in Hawaii. Sometimes it erupts in those powerful jets, what they call fire fountains or lava fountains. Other times the magma becomes more degassed and it comes out more quietly as lava flows that are a little safer to approach and look at. And so, yeah, the Hawaiian volcanoes are fascinating, and because they tend to be relatively non-explosive, one can get up close and personal in studying them.
When you were talking earlier about not being entirely sure what's in pyroclastic flows, I mean, it never occurred to me to think about the fact that, yeah, it's really hot and it's hard to get close enough to get samples. Is that part of the issue?
Yes, that's right. And so the part of the issue in understanding pyroclastic flows is the material that makes up the flow, you have hot gas, which is moving at you know, considerable speed down the volcano. And then you have hot particles. You have pumice and ash fragments. So you have, you know, solid rock-like particles of a variety of sizes. And those particles are all banging against one another. So that kind of becomes important in how the flow moves. And so we're unable, because we can't really see inside them, we don't know a lot about how that material is transported. If most of the particles are in kind of a dense ground-hugging layer that moves down, you know, as a granular flow process down the volcano, or if the particles are more dispersed throughout the cloud of gas as it moves. And those things are important for understanding how far pyroclastic flows are going to move in the end.
It seems like we have just sort of a basic instinctive fear of volcanoes. I can't remember a single kid who didn't play the "don't step on the hot lava" game when they were kids.
Which
prompted a question from a listener who didn't stay on the line, but it's a good question. He wants to know if we're in danger here where we live.
No, and this, you know, this is something I always try to be real careful in talking with people about volcanic hazards, because you want to, you know, let them know about what we know and what the hazards are, but you also don't want to, you know, you don't want to panic or scare people. right? And so, no, where we are certainly here in Eugene or in the, you know, in the Willamette Valley or on the west side of the Cascades, we're far enough away from the volcanoes up in the Cascades that it doesn't pose a hazard to us. You can think about the kinds of hazards, you know, that one could see from volcanoes based on the Mount St. Helens eruption in 1980. And at a more extreme end, you could look at something like the Crater Lake eruption about 7,000 years ago, which would have a much more widespread impact, sending pyroclastic flows down valleys and so forth. But those are fairly infrequent events. And so they're really the key to monitoring in the Cascades in the Pacific Northwest and other high threat or active volcanoes around the world is to make sure you've got instrument networks in place in advance so that if a volcano does start to rumble, you can very early on get a better understanding of what's going on.
So are there devices, for example, that monitor Crater Lake? I mean, it had the big eruption 7,000 years ago, but Wizard Island is proof that it has been active since.
Yes, as part of the Pacific Northwest Seismic Network that's operated cooperatively through a number of universities and the U.S. Geological Survey, there are seismometers that are in place in various places around the Cascades. There's a lot more instruments that need to be put in place. Many volcanoes are not instrumented nearly as much as they should be, so that's an ongoing push. But right now, the Pacific Northwest Seismic Network is expanding and setting up more stations. And again, that's a connection. They're also responsible for monitoring earthquakes with regard to big subduction zone earthquakes in the Pacific Northwest.
Dr. Paul Wallace, our guest on the Jefferson Exchange. This is our Curious segment. Curious is Research Meets Radio from the University of Oregon. Dr. Paul Wallace is the head of the University of Oregon Earth Sciences Department and the head of the Volcanology Cluster of Excellence, which recently got a bit of a funding boost. Do you have questions about volcanoes in our part of the world? We'd love to hear from you at 800-838-3760 by phone, by email, jx@jeffnet.org. You got a fairly good-sized financial boost a few months ago. Tell us about that, for this cluster, I mean.
Yes, we did. We were extremely fortunate. We got a magnificently generous gift from Charles and Gwen Lillis. They are longtime benefactors and supporters of the University of Oregon, and they were quite interested in the goals of our volcanology cluster. So we were really fortunate to get a gift from them, a large gift that will enable us to hire two new faculty members, set up state-of-the-art laboratory facilities for them, and so forth. So it really advances the key part of our goal in setting up this cluster of excellence, because these new positions I mentioned a few moments ago, the going in the direction of computer modeling and satellite remote sensing and deformation, it allows us to really go in some new directions that we haven't done with our program in the past, that helps us focus more on active volcanoes, the processes, explosive eruption processes there, and the kinds of hazards they create.
How specialized, Paul, are those positions? I mean, are we talking maybe a dozen people in North America who would be qualified for either one of those, or is it a lot of people who know those skills?
First of all, we advertise internationally. One of the great things about volcanology is it's a really international field. There's active volcanoes all around the world, so it's a great aspect of being able to work with researchers around the world. But yeah, for a position like this that is a little bit more specialized, we had about 60 applicants for the two positions.
And so, where do you stand with filling them?
Oh, we're in the process of interviewing right now. So we've moved forward. Once we got word of the gift last year, we moved forward pretty quickly in getting an ad placed, and we're in the process of interviewing people.
So I guess this all gets down to one major question, which is, I mean, for the millions and millions of years of volcanic activity on the face of planet Earth and all the evidence that those volcanoes have left behind, are volcanoes and their working still somewhat mysterious to us?
Yeah, there's a lot of mysterious things still, because so much happens out of sight of what we can see, right? You know, you once used as an example how a medical patient, you can go in and have a CAT scan done, and you can image the inside of the body and try to look at things. But we're at a point with volcanoes where we're at still a really rudimentary level. We have some techniques that allow us to determine where earthquakes are happening under a volcano, but we're a long way from having that kind of imaging ability where we can diagnose what's happening underground or in the volcano itself or within plumes and pyroclastic flows and so forth. So there's a lot of mysteries and puzzles still to be solved for us to better understand, better predict volcanic activity and therefore try to mitigate the impacts of hazards.
How deep into the planet do we know that the magma pockets and things are? I'm thinking Mount Mazama was about 16,000, 17,000 feet when it was in its original form. How far down below it was all the activity going on?
So where magma is often stored underneath big volcanoes like Mount Mazama or Mount St. Helens is often around 6 to 10 kilometers. So, 6 miles or a little less, four to 6 miles down. The magma itself is created much deeper in the Earth. In the Cascades, the magma is produced at about 80 kilometers depth, so about 50 miles down is where it's originally produced, and then it slowly makes its way, migrates up into the crust, and then accumulates into storage zones, reservoirs, that eventually pressurize enough to the point where they can erupt. So there's a whole kind of fascinating, discipline connected to volcanology that is focused on how and where magma forms in the Earth, why it forms, and how it makes its way to the surface to eventually erupt.
But we still can't say for sure if and when any of the Cascades that have been dormant for a while might come back to life, whether Mount Shasta still got some life left in, or Mount McLaughlin or Bailey or...
That's
or,
right. Yeah. Yeah, and almost certainly many of those big volcanoes do. Most of the big volcanoes in the Cascades have been active on and off for about the last half million years, and it's common for them to go hundreds of years without an eruption, for example. So Mount Shasta last erupted about 200 years or so ago. Mount Hood last had a more major eruption about 200 years ago. In fact, there's an interesting story. Mount Hood erupted most recently, just shortly before the Lewis and Clark expedition arrived. And what we now know as the Sandy River was originally named by their expedition the Quicksand River because of the mud flows that the eruption had created that had choked that entire area.
Oh, did it look a lot like the Cowlitz River looked in the years after the Mount St. Helens?
Exactly.
River?
Yeah, exactly.
Got it. Okay, all kinds of interesting things to talk about with volcanoes. You're our second volcano person in a week, but we're talking specifically about the Volcanology Cluster of Excellence at the University of Oregon, which is in the process, as you heard, of interviewing two new researchers to come on board to really ramp up what they're doing with volcanology. Dr. Paul Wallace is the head of that Cluster of Excellence and the head of the Earth Sciences Department at the University of Oregon. Paul, good to talk to you.
Thank you very much. It's a real pleasure to talk with you today.